And then bold, he continues, seeing the numbers really helps people make the best choice for themselves. I sell life insurance off of illustrations. I'm going to manipulate an illustration and make the numbers look bigger, better, faster, sooner. So you'll say yes. And I'll say all of these other things, half-truths, innuendos, omissions, some just outright lies, full of disparagement, to help you say yes. In this episode, I discuss a marketing email that was forwarded to me, and I know it was sent to many others, and I discuss it because it's just stereotypical of the type of half-truths and lies and dishonesty that exists in the infinite banking footprint and in the life insurance industry in general. I had fun doing it, and I hope you enjoy. I hope it helps. Welcome to the Bank with Life podcast. I'm your host, James Nethery. And today I'm going to maybe do something a little different. You know, I don't want to come across as, you know, a negative guy at all. However, I am going to discuss a particular marketing email that some of you may have, may not have received, but it's pretty egregious in my humble opinion. And so I just want to talk about it. And it really speaks to not only the infinite banking footprint, but the life insurance, you know, marketing historically, the way life insurance is historically marketed, and then this new age of digital marketing and all that. And, you know, I've had some clients share it with me. I've heard other people from across the country, you know, their clients or they themselves received something, or actually this exact email. And so I just want to discuss it, and I hope you find it of value. So the purpose in my mind for me even doing this is to, like, bring clarity, all right, and kind of address, you know, these half-truths in some of them, not all of them, right, but address some of the half-truths, you know, innuendos and error by omission, which could potentially be innocent, and not to indict anyone, but I just want to talk about some of the half-truths, the innuendos that we're all subjected to if we have an interest in the infinite banking concept. You know, if we want to practice becoming your own banker, it's almost like we have to endure some of this. Okay. And so I received this email from a client. All right. So the marketer obviously has their information or their email, or they'd have never received an email, right? And so I'm just going to go right down the email. And it opens up, "This is not good, comma, the name of the individual that received the email. Here are bullet points on pros and cons, where the cons far outweigh the pros, especially over multiple years." All right, and then the good in bold. Number one, highest early cash value. Number two, lump sum dump-in rider. Number three, direct recognition. And so let me rephrase that. They are marketing particularly to people that are potentially considering the infinite banking concept or buying life insurance and practicing this idea of becoming your own banker, and anyone who may have a policy with a particular company or have an interest in getting a particular company's product. And you know, if you've listened for any length of time, I loathe mentioning life insurance companies' names, right? But this was targeted against a particular life insurance company, or it's targeted to people that may have an interest in a particular life insurance company. So, you know, I may accidentally mention some life insurance company names as we go through here, although I'd really prefer not to. Okay. And so the good, highest early cash value, lump sum dump-in rider, non-direct recognition. These are the good points, right? Well, when you're looking at an illustration, you, the consumer, are looking at an illustration, you know, it's going to have a certain amount of cash value to premium and a certain amount of death benefit to premium. And it's like, you might not want to make a decision based on an illustration, okay? And that'll become clear of the marketing activities that go on within the life insurance industry. I hope as I go through this email, right? So a life insurance agent, if they know how to run software with every particular company, every life insurance company has their own software. So the agent can go in there and build an illustration. And they have various products, right? Sometimes the various products are designed to do different things or specific things. Every company is a little different, but they're all life insurance companies, right? And they're all mutual life insurance companies. And my point here is that if an agent or an advisor knows how to run the software, they can create these things. They can create, you know, a really high cash value in the early year or somewhere in the latter year. You know, they manipulate that, the inputs, to produce the output, the illustration, right? So it kind of generic. And he's talking about one particular company, and there's three good points, right? Oh my gosh, how broad can you be or how narrow can you get? Then he says a lump sum dump in rider. Let me be clear. That is, and I've even used or talked about that kind of language. There's not a single life insurance company in North America that has a rider. And I say he, right? It happens to be a male individual to my knowledge. Okay. So they're talking about a PUA rider, a paid up additions rider, right? There's not a single company in North America, to my knowledge, that calls any rider that they have on any product that they have available dump in. All right? It's like, yeah, no. So every company has PUA riders. Some companies have multiple PUA riders, right? They can have one, two, or three. And each of those paid up additions riders have their own names. You know, each company calls them something a little different, but they're paid up additions riders, right? And their design is a little bit different too. What do I mean by that? Well, one could be a blended PUA rider where the paid up additions rider is blended with a term component that functions a particular way as compared to a PUA rider that has no term component to it, okay? But my point here, not a single company has a single product called a lump sum dump in rider. But that's a good point that he is mentioning about this particular life insurance company. And then he says non-direct recognition is a good point. So, and I've talked about a lot of these things throughout the long form podcast that we've produced over the last 5 years. And I get it. Not everybody wants to listen to 30 minutes or an hour of nuanced conversation on life insurance. Okay. There's only two types of life insurance companies in the world, stock companies or mutual companies. All right. Stock companies are owned by the shareholders. Mutual companies are owned by the policyholders. And then when you have a mutual company, there's either a direct recognition company or a non-direct recognition company. And what does that mean? And this is my language, right? That a company directly recognizes when there's an outstanding loan. So when there is an outstanding loan, there is an adjustment to the dividend. All right. If you have $200,000 in cash value or loan value, and I have a $100,000 outstanding loan, I'm going to receive an adjusted dividend on that $100,000 that's outstanding in loans compared to the $100,000 of loan value that is not exercised, not collateralized, right? Two different dividends are credited. It's the same dividend rate by the company, right? Okay. And a non-direct recognition company doesn't adjust the dividend when there's an outstanding loan. So the dividend, unadjusted dividend, is paid on the whole $200,000 in loan value, whether any amount of it is collateralized or not. But it goes under the good. And then the email continues, and it's in bold. You know, the good is in bold. And then the continuation, the bad and the ugly. 3 points. Worst long-term performance. Again, it goes right back to how the illustration was manipulated by the professional or the pseudo-professional, right? They're trying to manipulate the illustration to get you to the point of saying yes. That's what I believe goes on in the big wide world of life insurance. The point two on the bad and the ugly, not a true mutual company. Number three, the highest loan rate at 7% in parentheses with no company subsidy. So the implication there is that the worst long-term performance, in his opinion, right? Lumps, no, that's a good, not a true mutual company. That's his opinion or his verbiage. And then highest loan rate at 7% with no company subsidy. Okay. Worst long-term performance? Oh, I think not. No, I think not. When you build all the products legitimately, comparatively, both of the companies which he's referencing are good, in my opinion, the type of company that you would want to own and participate with. Not a true mutual. The company that he's specifically speaking about was a mutual company, demutualized, so they could be purchased by another company. And so when you demutualize, you become a stock company. And this particular company that, you know, he's disparaging is a mutual holding company. So they demutualized from a mutual company. Now they're a stock company. And this particular company that he's disparaging did it for a particular reason, so they could be purchased by another company. And that other company created a mutual holding company to purchase the demutualized company. All right. And he goes on, but I'm going to continue. Why would a company do that? You know, and he throws out it like it's a ruse that most of the time, well, I don't know why companies do what they do. This particular company demutualized so they could be purchased by a larger company, and the larger company created a mutual holding company that now owns the company, right? Okay, so, and I think I'm going to do another episode, and I'm going to like really name names and get a little deeper into this, but that will be in our client-only section at thebankingwithlife.com, our website. Okay, so what does that do? It allows this company to operate with mutuality, right? And it costs these companies a lot of money to put business on the books. And all that cost is not the commission of a life insurance agent. Right? They have to have reserves and all of their expenses. And for a mutual company to get new business, to be able to afford new business, to be able to fund and finance, you know, how do they pay? They got to have capital. So if you're a particular size company and you have a limited access to capital, right, you can't issue shares of stock and raise capital, right? You go out on the market and borrow money, you know, surplus bonds and all of that. But the point here is it costs a company money to put policies on the books. This particular situation, the company demutualized so a larger company could purchase them. They did that through a mutual holding company. And I'll get a little bit deeper into that later. So this true, which, you know, not a true mutual company. Well, no, they're a mutual holding company. And what is this true mutual company, right? Like it's something that, you know, is the whole, this whole email was designed to put fear and doubt and in the reader's mind. And the way he's written this, it leads them through outright lies, omissions, half-truths, and innuendos. That's the mechanism that is used to get to the reader's end result of doing business with him and a particular company. And you know what? You can market however you want to. Everybody is free to do whatever they want to do. I'm not the police. It's just a sad state of affairs, in my opinion, and just speaks to the marketing efforts within the Infinite Banking footprint and the quote unquote competitive marketing tactics of, you know, the life insurance industry in and of itself. Okay, the point three on the bad and the ugly is the highest loan rate at 7%. There's only one company that had a 7% loan interest rate at the time of this email, which is April of 2025. So he's speaking very specifically of a one company. And then in parentheses, with no company subsidy. I wonder if the average reader, listener would know what that is implying, right? I don't know either, but as I read it, it must be bad if they don't have it. Yeah, it's not bad at all. That should be right up there in the good, right? No, they don't subsidize their dividends. They don't sell assets most of the time that are profitable and cash flowing because those are the most valuable assets. So a company doesn't sell an asset to support a dividend when their portfolio couldn't support the dividend. All right. So it's not good, in my humble opinion, 35 years in the life insurance business. It just is what it is. 20 plus years experience in the Infinite Banking footprint, practicing professionally, personally. The implication there is that no subsidy is bad. I'm telling you it's the exact opposite. If a company, their portfolio, their management, their financial strength, right, their financial philosophy is not able to like declare a legitimate dividend and pay it, might be a red flag. All right. Okay. This continues in bold, like BTW. By the way, if you have Lafayette, or are considering it, send over your illustration and we'll show you the top true mutual companies optimally designed for the same premium schedule, with the same premium schedule. And it's like, okay, this is really what's going on. If you own Lafayette Life, there's a 7% loan rate at the time of the email. They're not a true mutual company, worse long-term performance, and there's no company subsidy with the loan rate. It's like, you know, if you're in the financial services industry for any length of time and you're moderately successful or active, or I should say inactive, if you're a member of any organization or you have designations and affiliations, you know, each one of those entities, each one of those organizations, each one of those affiliations, each one of those designations all have a code of conduct. Every one of them. They're similar, but they're not identical, right? About professional practices, right? And this violates every one of them, in my opinion. And so there's a reason there's a code of conduct in all these organizations, right? And I'm just bringing that up because this wouldn't check the box with any of the codes of conducts of any. And I don't know if there's affiliations, designations, and organizations. I don't know how long individuals practice successful. I have no idea. But to disparage a company directly, I'm not an attorney, but I don't even know if that's legal. All right. I don't know if that's legal within the profession of life insurance. Okay. I just don't think it is. Okay. So he wants you to send an illustration so he can manipulate the software that he's learned how to operate and to make the numbers look bigger, better, faster, stronger, or whatever. Right. So you'll do business with them. Then he continues. Let's start with the bad and the ugly. Since Lafayette Life has always been known for being so IBC friendly, IBC, the infinite banking concept. Well, that's an opinion and just a statement. You know, we can all say anything we want. Right. So I don't know what IBC friendly is. Is it known in North America that Lafayette Life Insurance Company is one of the premier companies to practice the infinite banking concept with? Yeah, the answer is yes. And if a professional has been in the infinite banking footprint or practiced the infinite banking concept for any length of time, and they're worth their salt, and they study and they learn and improve themselves, that's a natural conclusion that they'll get to. My humble opinion that Lafayette Life is one of the premier companies to do business with. And let me be clear, I am not a water boy for Lafayette Life or any other life insurance company. I'm not, okay? I'm married to my wife. I'm not married to these life insurance companies. And then in big, bold print, so why then did they raise their loan rate last year from 5 to 7%? So this is 2025, so he's saying 2024. And so that creates, oh my gosh, that's like a real doubt in your mind. Why would they do that? Well, let me ask you a question. Why would any company do anything with their loan interest rates? Why would they move them up or down? Why would they declare their dividend rates? Why would they move them up and down? All right. Well, if they're a well-run mutual company, and that's my broad terminology that I've used for a very long time, and I know it's very broad. If a well-run mutual company, if a company is a well-run mutual company, they're going to make these decisions on what the dividend interest credit rate is or declared, you know, what they declare, and what their loan rates are, up or down, for the health of the company. That's why they do what they do. All right, for the health of the company. Well, that kind of makes sense if they're in the life insurance business, and they are, and that's their product, that's their service. The life insurance is a contract, and it's a guaranteed contract. Right? There are some non-guaranteed components like the dividend that are included in that contract, no question. But it's a 100% guarantee that you're going to graduate, we're all going to get graduated, right? We're all going to graduate. None of us are going to get out of here alive. So if I buy life insurance, that's a guaranteed obligation to the company, right? And when they go through underwriting, you know, if you can't qualify for underwriting, you're not on your deathbed, right? The odds are you're going to live a long time. So those guarantees are out into the future, a very long time from now. So a company must be prudent, right, to meet those future obligations. And that will require them to increase and decrease their dividends over time, and it will require them to raise and lower interest rates. That's why companies do what they do. He continues, and it's kind of separated, you know, for an easy read, which I appreciate. Could this be the canary in the coal mine? Are you kidding me? Because a company moves their loan interest rate 2 points in a given year? It's like, what a straw man comment. What a straw man fake comment, right? Canary in the coal mine. He happens to be talking about a company that is a Fortune, or backed up, owned by the, you know, mutual holding company. Yeah, Fortune 500 company, all right? And then the company that he wants you to purchase, good company, one of the few companies that I've even mentioned by name on this podcast. Been a couple of years, you know, and some Yahoo was talking about the big four, the big four, the big four. I'm like, why are you leaving out Penn Mutual? All right, so he wants you to own Penn Mutual is ultimately the goal here. The canary, and Penn Mutual, they're not a Fortune 500 company. What does that mean? You determine what that means. That's a fact. Go look up Fortune 500 companies. You can print out an updated list and see who's where. Okay? So is this a canary in the coal mine? My short answer is yeah, no. It's a company being prudent financially to ensure that they can meet their future obligations. And just, you know, I don't know when this is going to be released, but at the time Lafayette Life increased their loan rate, and they increased them on one series of policies. You know, in 2022 with the the change, you know, to the MEC rules and the reserve requirements of the life insurance company on these policies. I forget the Appropriations Act 2022. All of these companies had to create new products. You know, every company had to block off business, right? Because every policy that was issued after 2022, they have a new basis of values that, that must be used for their internal calculations of reserve on a life insurance policy. I know I may be speaking Greek to you, but every company had to do this. My point here is Lafayette Life raised the loan interest rate to 7 on that one block of business. Right? Not every other policy that was issued prior did they move to 7%. All right. And at the time that they did that, if you want to go back in time into 2024, is exactly when the Fed was increasing their rates. So if you back up and look beyond a jank, markety, clickbaity, less than honest email and like engage with somebody who's a professional and has maybe your best interests in mind, right? And see a broader picture, it makes total sense. My humble opinion, okay, just like I'm assuming these are his opinions, so we all have one, right? Nobody wants to hear it. I get it. Okay. Is this a canary in the coal mine? No, no, not at all. It's a company being prudent financially. Oh, it's well run. Okay, thank you. That's exactly the kind of business that I want an ownership position in, all right, because the policyholders own the company. Right, the policyholders own the company if they're a mutual company, even if it's a mutual holding company. Okay. All right. Did they give away too many sweetheart loans to policyholders for too long, and now they have to true up their books? I mean, you got to be kidding me. You got to be kidding me. There's no such thing as a sweetheart loan. You can't go to anywhere in your life insurance contract, anywhere on a life insurance company's information, and there's like plenty of information available in the big wide world, easily accessible for all of these life insurance companies. Nowhere does the word sweetheart loans appear. There, in fact, is no such thing. In the life insurance business, there is no such thing as a sweetheart loan. He gets into the loan provisions down here somewhat, right? The loan provision in your life insurance contract, and that's exactly what they both are. The life insurance policy is a contract. The loan provision is a provision of that contract. And the owner of that contract has all the ownership, the rights of ownership of that contract, and there's a loan provision in your life insurance policy, and you should be familiar with them, in my opinion. If you own life insurance or you're considering buying life insurance, you should understand what the loan provision is, right, and what the limitations are. It's spelled out clearly in layman's terms. You don't even have to be a lawyer to read it and understand it. All right, they use plain English. Okay. I digress. I'm not trying to come at anybody individually. Just the whole basis of marketing like this in the infinite book, in the infinite banking footprint, and in the life insurance industry just bothers me, right? Okay. So there is no such thing as a sweetheart loan. The rate is the rate is the rate is the rate. And the declared rate is declared by the life insurance company. And you know what? Even the every life insurance company has internal mechanisms and controls that have to be met before a dividend is paid, adjusted, or a loan rate is made, declared, given, or adjusted. You know, it's not like one day the life insurance company woke up and said, oh, let's lower the loan interest rates. Oh, let's raise the loan interest rates. That idea is extremely simplistic. There are loan committees. There are business committees. Each company is a little different. And then there are outside indices like the 30-year intermediate corporate bond aggregate as published in Moody's or the Wall Street Journal or whatever. The loan interest rate would be tied to something like that. And they have to go through loan committees. And they have to go through business committees. which are two different committees chaired by two different people. And I'm not saying every company, but typically, okay? All right. Then he continues. Oh, wait, no. Yeah, it's like, so there are no sweetheart loans that were given for too long. And now they have to true up their books. The implication is you think 2% on a loan rate is going to true up. What kind of language is this? The implication is that their books are not accurate. They're not. Are they fraudulent? Are they, you know, what does that mean? True up your books, right? Well, it means whatever they can conjure up in your mind, I guess. Their books are off. They're not profitable. I mean, what does that really mean? So we know there are no sweetheart loans. I mean, if you think that through, I'm surely you would agree with that statement that there are no sweetheart loans, right? And now that they've given policy owners for too long, it's a contractual right in a contract. The life insurance company wrote the contract. Do you think for a minute they're going to give a policyholder or a block of policyholders the ability to cause them financial distress because of loans? It's like, that's simplistic. So the implication is the books of Lafayette Life need to be trued up. And apparently they're doing that by increasing the loan rate. Oh my gosh. If this kind of stuff resonates with you and it encourages you to buy any life insurance, the infinite banking concept is not for you. If your understanding of the infinite banking concept is so limited, right, that this kind of marketing can sway you, my encouragement would be to continue your discovery and your education and your learning. And then he continues, remember, with non-direct recognition, they don't credit your policy with any kind of dividend boost. In parentheses, unlike how direct recognition can true up your policy. Okay, so now your policy may not be trued up. He's talking about non-direct recognition. It's not the company that's trying to true up their books. Right. But the company's going to give you a boost because they're non or because they are direct recognition and they're going to true up your policy. It's like this is almost comical. Right. And so if I get back to the dividend comment earlier, if their general portfolio, if their investment portfolio can't support the dividend, then they have declared a dividend that is too high for their portfolio to support. So they must subsidize it. They must go borrow money through surplus loans, or they must sell off other assets that they own. And again, if they need money to the point where they're selling off assets, those assets are probably going to be valuable, producing income, have increased in value. So you're going to sell off a valuable asset to true up a policy, the dividend on a policy loan. It's like not prudent financially, in my little humble opinion. If the company doesn't have enough capital to pay a dividend, then they've got to go borrow capital to pay the dividend that they've declared, or they have to sell assets to pay the dividend that they declared. Does that remotely sound like prudent financial practice or prudent financial activities? And I'm not saying because a company does that, it's a bad company, but it's like, yeah, no, that doesn't give me the warm fuzzies. Then he copies a section out of a Lafayette Life illustration and highlights the disclosure. And let me be clear, a life insurance illustration is not a contract. There's not a contractual provision in a life insurance illustration. The contractual provisions are in the life insurance policy because it's a contract. This is nothing more than a disclosure on a life insurance illustration, which all of them from every company are full of disclosures, and you should read them. Okay, if you're going to own them or considering purchasing them, whomever they are. And but then he highlights some things, you know, so the loans will be charged interest. Loans will be charged interest payable to Lafayette Life at an adjustable loan interest rate that we have and may change from year to year. He highlights that. Then he highlights this. The maximum loan interest rate is 8%. He didn't highlight that. He continues, and the life insurance company even put this in bold in the life insurance illustration. I've talked about bolded print and other various companies' life insurance illustrations and wonder why a company would put something in bold, a disclaimer, a disclosure in bold. They want you to read it, okay? And so what this company has put in bold is interest that you pay to us is not credited to the cash value of the policy and does not increase the cash value of the policy. Wonder why he would highlight that. That statement is in fact true with every life insurance company, even the ones he wants you to buy. I mean, I feel manipulated and I didn't even, I'm only on page two. All right. And so I have another question. And so, you know, and I sure don't know everything. I do not have the arrival syndrome. you know, I don't know. I question whether it's legal to use a one page out of a or part of an illustration. And in fact, every illustration will have another disclosure or disclaimer on there that the illustration is not complete unless all pages are presented. It's not a legitimate, it's not a valid, whatever their language is, every company has this disclosure that the illustration is not complete or valid unless all pages are included. All right, so he's taken out one section of a disclaimer on an illustration, which is not a contract, and then he highlights the obvious that the company is even bolded, right? And my question is this, because, you know I'm a bit old school. You know, it's been 30 years since I got a license, 34, 35. But I distinctly remember that it is illegal in the life insurance business, at least in the state of Texas, right, to use partial illustrations. Yeah. And it's also illegal, to my understanding, of course laws could have changed, to highlight an illustration. So when you're, you know, talking with a financial professional when it comes to life insurance and they're highlighting this and they're highlighting that, I question whether it's legal or not. I know at one time it wasn't. I don't know if it is now. It may be. I don't know. But I digress. Then he continued, the real scary thing in the policy contract language, parentheses, that no one ever reads. I agree, most people don't, but a lot of people do, and you would behoove yourself to read them. And if you're going to be in the infinite banking footprint, if you're going to practice this idea of the infinite banking concept, it's okay to spend some time reading and rereading the loan provision and the paid up additions rider provision as well, and every other rider that you have, right? Because, and why do you say that, James? Well, because if I'm going to capitalize a policy, i.e. pay a premium, and I'm going to create cash value, and then I'm going to collateralize that cash value to exercise a loan provision to go do whatever it is I'm going to do anyway, I would want to know how that paid up additions rider worked, because an awful lot of cash is going into the paid up additions rider. And I'm going to collateralize it through a loan. So I'd want to know at least the loan provision, and I would at least want to be fairly familiar, absolutely comfortable with the paid up additions rider. All right, that's kind of simplistic in my mind. So he continues, the really scary thing in the policy contract language that no one ever reads is that their non-subsidized loan is capped at 8%, making Lafayette Life's 7% loan just 1% away from its cap in the middle of the road interest rate environment. Man, at least some math can be done. Perfect. 8's the cap. It was at the time 7, 1% difference. mathematical genius right here, right? Okay. In the middle of the road interest rate environment, maybe he's an economist too and can predict what the Fed's going to do with interest rates. I don't know. That's just a question. I don't necessarily agree or disagree whether it's the middle of the road or the, you know, I know that we're coming out of about a 15-year interest rate low environment, and we have been for the last few years, right? But the Fed met just last week or two, and they're not changing rates, and that's important, okay? And I might bring it up right here. The Fed's not changing rates. So if we go back, and this is my humble opinion, I am not speaking for Lafayette Life Insurance. I am not. I am just speaking as a life insurance agent to the general public. Okay? I'm not speaking for Lafayette Life, nor am I speaking for Penn Mutual or any other company that he references here. Not speaking. I am speaking from me, my knowledge, my experience, my understanding in the life insurance business of 34 years, practicing the infinite banking concept for over 20. That's where I'm coming from, okay? So they're non-subsidy loan, right? The implication is that that's a bad thing. They're not even subsidizing the loan. And it's at 7 and the cap is at 8. Oh my gosh, and it's just the middle of the road interest rate environment. Okay. If someday the Fed does have to raise prevailing interest rates from 5 to 8 or 11, like through most of the 80s, I think Nelson tells you the interest rates were raised in 1980, 1981, right, to 21.5%, right? That's what occurred in 1980, or close to it. He continues, then Lafayette Life, in bold or capital letters, must squash everyone's dividend, in parentheses, whether they borrow or not, in parentheses, to compensate for all the money leaving their general portfolio at 8%. That's an accusation, an innuendo, that is designed, written, the whole thing is designed and written to you, for you, the reader, to be disturbed if you have Lafayette Life, if you own them, or if you're considering them, and to reach out to him and he'll do his magic and make everything better. Full of inaccuracies, outright lies, half-truths, and innuendos, right? So let's think that through for a minute. All right, so interest rates went sky high in the 80s, right? They didn't last very long, right? But, you know, that's the very reason some of these companies changed their loan provision on some policies at that time. They went from fixed to variable. They increased their limits on fixed. You know, lots of things like that happened or occurred so the life insurance company could deal with long-term higher interest rates, right? No question about that. Okay. Well, if they're going to be long-term higher, I mean, all of these life insurance companies can endure a blip in high interest rates. They don't have to do a dang thing, nothing. They sure don't have to squash a dividend. They don't have to do anything, right? The loan provision, if there's adjustments, they're going to be, you know, adjusted. Oh, wait, a non-direct recognition company that adjusts a dividend on an outstanding loan, do you think they might not increase their adjustment to the negative? So if I borrow money at 6, or no, let's say the dividend is at 6 on a non-direct recognition company, and I borrow the life insurance company money, collateralizing that cash value. You know, it's quite common that, like, for one company that I'm not going to name, the dividend on the collateralized amount, the loaned amount, goes from 6, the 6% dividend paid on the policy without a loan or the portion of the loan value that's not collateralized, but then they pay 6, but then they pay 4.5 points on the amount that's collateralized. Okay, that's math, right? We can all do math. That's a 25% adjustment, dividend adjustment, because they are a direct recognition company. So the policyholder is already paying the loan rate, whatever it is, plus there's an adjustment to the dividend. And in my example, which is in fact true, with a particular company that I'm not going to name, pays a 6% dividend on money that's not collateralized, and they pay 4.5% on money that is collateralized, that's a 25% adjustment on the dividend. That's exactly the adjustment is what occurs on a direct recognition company. A company that adjusts the dividend on the balance of the outstanding loan. That loan amount that's collateralized, the dividend is adjusted, right? In my experience, it's always negative. Could a company just adjust a dividend upwards? You know, yes, they could. But think that through. The loan rate is 6. I'm going to pay, as a life insurance company, I'm going to pay you to get a loan? Yeah, no. My humble opinion, I mean, is it the end of the world you have direct or non-direct? No, it's not the end of the world. My preference is that you have a non-direct recognition company. They don't directly recognize an outstanding loan. If you look at what that dividend adjustment is, it's just another cost of capital. Right? If the loan rate is 6, 7, or 8, whatever it is, that's the loan rate. If the life insurance company is going to adjust my dividend down, that's an increased cost to the capital. I don't care how you define that. I don't care how you create a beautiful presentation to argue against that. In fact, that's what it is. All right. But is it the end of the world? No. Okay. And so the implication here is if interest rates go up as they did in the 80s, you know, then Lafayette Life is going to have to squash the dividend. So not true. Like I said, every company could withstand a short to moderate duration of increased interest rates, right, without adjusting their dividend. Let me say this and see if you agree or don't agree or just consider this, right? If I'm in a life insurance company and I have to have an investment portfolio because I got to meet these future obligations that are guaranteed obligations to me in the future, and the Fed raises the interest rates to 20, do you think that bond interest rates would go up? Every other loan interest rate would go up? But there's an awful lot of assets that a life insurance company can actually own and invest in that are going to increase in their rates as well. So if the interest rates go up, the profitability of the company could actually go up. And if the profitability of a company goes up, that's your financial experience, that's exactly what the dividend is the policy owner's share portion of the interest experience or the financial experience of a life insurance company in a given year. So the Fed raises rates for a long duration. All of the other investment rates and returns to the life insurance company are going to go up, and the dividends are going to follow. Oh my gosh. It's just so not rocket science. It's not. So no, the company, I don't believe there may be some marginal companies out there. I'm just talking about all of the legitimate life insurance companies that operate within the Infinite Banking footprint. I think most all of them can withstand a short to moderate duration of increased interest rates. Not going to change a thing. And if it turns into a long duration of increased interest rates, their profits are going to follow. Okay. Which means that the dividend will follow as well. The next thing, you've got a little emoji pointing up. That is scary stuff for a policy you plan to keep your whole life through different cycles. Well, the way it's presented, whoever wrote this, you know, is doing their dangest to make the reader scared. Nothing scary there, in my little humble opinion, none. The only thing scary is the level of dishonesty that this whole email entails. That's scary. Okay, even if you really want a non-direct, they're so bad you surely couldn't want one, but if you do, then why not use one of the biggest, oldest, bold, or capitalized True Mutual? What is True Mutual? A company that hadn't demutualized? I don't know. companies like, and he names them, Big Blue and another really old life insurance company. And if you're a receiver of this type of email, let me tell you why you might consider using a particular company. Their philosophy, right? The companies that he names do not like the infinite banking concept at all. Their agents can't promote the infinite banking concept, becoming your own banker. They in no way, as a matter of fact, their contracts are subject to be canceled, right? And one of them has, one of them, Big Blue, put out a memo, the first memo, I believe, in January 1, 2024, distinctly laying out their position on the infinite banking or infinite bank. They never named infinite banking concept, never put that. They named all of these other things, bank on yourself, infinite banking. They don't like that business, and they don't want the agents that write that type of business, quote unquote, infinite banking concept type of business. And the other company is not interested at all, right? So philosophy goes a long way. He names two companies that their philosophy is diametrically opposed to the infinite banking concept. And they tell you, these companies tell you that in their verbiage, in their online stuff. You can go find it, right? It's not a secret. I'm not making it up. That memo that went out, I mean, that's like, oh my gosh. And the life insurance agents that got their policies or their contracts canceled, and then wonder why. It speaks to the same kind of scary stuff that's going on here. You know, the life insurance companies, they appoint and contract with, you know, tens of thousands of agents, right? And they got tens of thousands of independent agents out there doing whatever it is they're doing. And some of them are doing this, right? You think the companies want that kind of responsibility? I think not. That's why those two companies have made it very clear on their philosophy of the infinite banking idea. Okay. Then he goes on to say, well, now we're going to, I asked earlier, he bold, what do I mean by true mutual company, quote unquote? And I hate to tell you, but he does not give an explanation of that. It doesn't exist here. He goes on, most people don't realize, but Lafayette Life is a mutual holding company, which technically a stock company that's still owned 100% by its policyholders. That's all true. In parentheses, for the moment, like, there's a possibility that Lafayette Life is for sale. Just for the moment. Yeah, for the moment, every mutual company is a mutual company. For the moment, every mutual holding company is a mutual holding company. For the moment, the way things are is the way things are for the moment. Right? Okay. But he continues, and I kind of address a mutual holding company, but let me be more specific since I've mentioned life insurance companies' names. You know, the policyholders with Lafayette Life, whatever company you own, I don't care if it's an annuity contract, a life insurance policy, those guarantees are provided by the issuing company, right? And they're backed up by their claims paying ability, all right? So Lafayette Life is making all of the guarantees that they make. They're the ones making them. Lafayette Life is making the guarantees. And those guarantees are backed up by their claims paying ability. All right. So, okay. That is what it is. Insurance companies shift from, this, he continues, shift from true mutual to mutual holding company, often under the guise that it's easier to raise capital, period. That is, in fact, a true statement. But that's, in my humble opinion, in my humble experience, that is, in fact, true. Companies that cost money, it costs companies money to put policies on the books. And if a company is growing so fast or they want a certain amount of business, you know, it costs them a certain amount of money, and there's only a few things that a mutual holding or mutual company can do is like go borrow money, right? Surplus bonds or whatever. And even that activity is regulated. So it's not like these are all cowboys out there, the life insurance companies. And that is in fact true. However, it's the first organizational step towards demutualization is the next step. It's the first organizational step towards demutualization. Now, doesn't that sound hermeneutical? Doesn't that sound like, oh my gosh, yeah, that's so correct. Demutualization is demutualization. That's what it is. It's not the first it's already done, right? If a mutual company demutualizes, it's done. It's not the first organizational step in anything. It's done, okay? Then he continues, even if they delay demutualizing for decades, it's common for policyholders of a mutual company to experience dilution per ChatGPT. I want to back up. There's only two reasons a company demutualizes, in my humble opinion, in my humble experience. Number one is the ability to raise capital. Number two is the ability to be sold. Period. That's it. All right. Well, number three, they would want to convert into a stock company so they could issue shares and sell shares. There's three. That's also true. All right. But then this idea of dilution per ChatGPT, I know AI and I'm heavy on the artificial, I'm heavy on the artificial part of intelligence, but it's a tool. I like it. I think we've all gamed with it a little bit or played around with it. Grok, ChatGPT, Gemini, or whomever. And you can just about get the prompt, whatever prompt you put in, it's going to spit something back, and then you can manipulate it. And it's not always honest, I have found, right? I mean, I printed this stuff out. And then you go back and question it, ChatGPT or Grok or just AI. Excuse me. And then AI responds, oh, yes, I'm sorry, you're right. This, and this. Oh, yes, I'm sorry, you're right. So you out and out gave me bad information. I called you on it. You recognized it, apologized for it, and then improved it. It's like, okay. And my only point there is, he's referencing ChatGPT on dilution. And then there's a little bit of a section that was either ChatGPT actually produced this or he manipulated it. Who knows? The way the illustrations are manipulated, that's a legitimate question. And got a big red X. Reduced policyholder control. Policy owners may retain nominal ownership, but real control often shifts to the executives and outside shareholders. All right, which may be true. Let's break that down. The policyholders retain nominal control. Let me share some info on policyholder control. So who owns a mutual company? The policyholders do. Okay. And a mutual holding company owns the same amount or enjoys the same amount of control. The only thing they have is voting rights. That's all they have. The policyholder, that's all they have. And the contractual rights of the policy. But as an ownership position, they have a voting right. Right? Every year, if you own a mutual company, you get, the mailings that you want to vote. You want to vote by proxy. Right? You can show up to the shareholder meetings while they do a vote. That's your contractual right as a policyholder of a mutual company. Let me share something with you. And all you financial gurus, you may know this, you may not. I don't know. I don't think most people are aware of the fact. Every mutual life insurance company in North America has more voting rights than the policyholders. Why? I don't know when policyholders die. I mean, I really don't know. A legitimate question would be, when the policyholder dies, does their voting rights die with them? I don't know. But if they have 1 million policyholders, there's 1 million, voting rights, right? 1 million policyholders, you get one vote per policyholder, per policy. I'm telling you, every mutual life insurance company owns more voting rights than the policy owners. All right, so if you think you're going to put together a little group and go up there and storm a life insurance company, whether it's mutual holding company, and change what they do or don't do, you're sadly mistaken. Okay. So my point here is a little info, but they own the same rights of ownership on a mutual holding company as a mutual company. There's no difference. But then he continues, but the real control often shifts to the executives and outside shareholders. Let me tell you, that's where the real power is in the executives. Not every mutual holding company has outside shareholders, right? But if they did, that could be in fact true, right? But the mutual holding company has, policyholder has the same ownership as a mutual company because they own a policy. Right. And I'm just saying their rights beyond the policy contract is the right to vote. Okay. So there's no really mystery there. Just the way it's presented is not only less than clear, and I don't want to be redundant, but, you know, it's just not even, it's surely not thorough, and it's surely not clear, and it's surely not honest. Okay. And then he continues the ChatGPT, dilution of mutual benefits, dividends, and other surplus benefits may be redirected towards stockholders. You know, that could be true. The potential, continues, the potential conflict between policyholder interest and shareholder returns. It's like, you know, it's almost like, I mean, it's almost like ChatGPT is referencing stock companies, you know, or cross some lines between mutual companies, mutual holding companies, and stock companies. But I could be wrong. There are no other shareholders in most mutual holding companies. There are none, you know. Okay. And then the risk of full demutualization later. You're either demutualized or not. So this idea of full demutualization by ChatGPT, and I don't know if ChatGPT spit this out, is just prima facie not, it's erroneous, right? You are either a mutual company or you have demutualized. That's a step. There's no in between. So if I demutualize, I'm done. There's no continuing demutualization. It's done. So critics say mutual holding company conversion can be a stepping stone toward full demutualization, which is just continuation of the realization. I'll repeat that. My little humble understanding, there's only three primary reasons that a company demutualizes from a mutual company to a stock company. It is either number one, to be able to raise capital, number one, to be purchased by someone, right? Because they don't have access to enough capital to do what they want to do, right? And then that's primarily it, right? And so if somebody purchases them, you know, it could be, a stock company could come purchase them, right? A mutual holding company could be created to own them. But the primary reason, my understanding for demutualization, is to be sold, right? To operate as a stock company. That's the other one. You know, just want to operate as a stock company. Okay. Then he continues, we have helped a lot of people rescue their, in capitalized letters, demutualized Ohio National policies late last decade when they got bought out for a song by a Canadian pension fund and policyholders left holding a crap policy. Well, that's his judgment on the value of the policies that Ohio National policyholders were left with. I think if you were, and I don't agree with the way Ohio National, what they did, and let me speak on my little knowledge of Ohio National. You know, they were a mutual company, very old, very long existing, and never failed to pay dividends. But they weren't really operated as a well-run mutual company. There were reasons they had to demutualize and be sold. And let me tell you, most of the big life insurance companies in North America that actively buy other life insurance companies, they all passed on Ohio Mutual. And then, you know, the Canadian pension fund teachers and another entity that are using really public or private dollars, you know, private dollars, the teachers in Canada, you know, they funded an entity that then was created and then went and bought Ohio National. And I don't agree with the outcome or the purpose of that. I never agreed with Ohio Mutual anyway. You could tell what they were doing and some of their activities. It was almost a matter of time, whether it was 1 year, 10 years, or 15 years before, you know, they had to demutualize and be sold. And I just wish one of these other larger mutual companies would have bought them. But they all looked at Ohio National and said, yeah, no, thank you. You have too much risk on the books. We're not going to assume the risk. No, thank you. You're not profitable. Okay. But then, a hedge fund comes and buys them. Yeah, I wonder why, because they have all the reserves and now the hedge fund can go out and leverage, you know, like a life insurance company. I know it's hard to believe sometimes, but a life insurance company, they operate on between a 6% and 8% margin. You think a hedge fund company is going to operate on a 6% to 8% margin? Yeah, no. They're going to get those reserves of the life insurance company, Ohio Mutual in this case, and they're going to leverage the fire out of it because they operate off of a 10, 12, 14% margin. Yeah. So it is important at the end of the day. It's very important for the policy owner to, you know, have some education, some understanding of the companies that they're purchasing beyond this marketing stuff. All right. And then, you know, this continues. We can already see the dilution effect happening in Lafayette Life's projected cash values and death benefit performance compared to these true mutuals when taking income, where it's not even close. This is so less than honest. You know, then again, he takes, you know, parts of illustrations. Who knows the construct of them? Who knows the age of them? I mean, you know, you look through there and it's like there's a wall of numbers here. And, you know, even there's no way that a consumer can look at that and go through and determine what they're looking at. And I think that's all completely on purpose, right? And because he said the screenshot below is 2025 whole life company review page and video from our review page and video. Oh, that's the source you're going to cite? Okay. You know, showing steady income from 67 to 89. With some steadier than others, you know, and then there's a wall of numbers. It says the red numbers are when they instead have to pay premiums back just to save the policy, in parentheses, instead of getting the income they counted on. Man, is talk about playing games with numbers on a page. That's exactly what's going on here. And then these straw man arguments, and then you're going to create the fake narrative to begin with, and then you're going to create the fake solution. It's like, man. Okay. What about Lafayette Life's redeeming qualities? Oh my gosh, in his humble opinion, they have some redeeming qualities? Well, lucky Lafayette Life, he's got a positive opinion. Oh my gosh. Okay. Well, their high early cash value is best. Compared to what? You know, that again gets to the policy structure. You ever wonder or ask yourself why, James, you harp on structure as much as you do and have for 5 years? It's stuff like this is why I harp on structure. And if you don't have the right structure, I don't care what you think you're going to get in the future, it's probably not going to occur exactly like you think, unless you have an understanding of the structure, right? And why something is structured that way, why your policy should be structured in a particular way. It's not to compete with other life insurance salesmen. It's not to compete with these types of salesmen. You know, it's to do what you want it to do. If it's to provide income, it's to provide income. And all of them should provide income in the future at some point in time, you know, passive income. And to practice this idea, you know, to accumulate capital, number one, you can't perform the banking function without capital. So capital accumulation is like, that's, yeah, okay. Yeah. All the policies should accumulate capital. If you want to practice banking, then do you want to have enough capital accessible to practice whatever the banking function, or however much of the banking function you want to control is? And then, you know, passive income in the future. Oh, my goodness, if you graduate between here and there, there's a death benefit that's paid to your loved ones. It's a beautiful thing. Okay. But the high early cash values, that's just another straw man. You know, oh, that's a plus because, you know, an agent has manipulated an illustration to have high early cash values. Okay. I wonder how much of the structure was jeopardized, right? And the long-term structure of a policy, you know, that's my question. Anyway, but how long do they stay in first place, you know, comparatively with the high early cash values? And then his illustration, he's trying to point out that Lafayette Life is going to, or that policyholder is going to, you know, run out of money and have to pay it back in the future. Well, something's clearly wrong if you have anything like that. But anyway, here's a wall of numbers, and you're supposed to be able to look at these numbers and, like, get so disheveled that you got to call them and, you know, do something. All right, you can see around the seventh year, you know, the other true mutuals are pretty much caught up. Not only that, but none of them were never really that far behind in the prior years. Then he throws up another wall of numbers, you know, and it's just – He mentions the companies, you know, he doesn't mention the products. All these companies have different products, and he doesn't get into the structure. You can kind of tell some of the structure on some of them, but it's like none of this is, you don't know, you know, when the life insurance company built an illustration, you know, there's so many things that they can do to manipulate the illustration, right? And you have no idea what was done behind the scenes to produce these walls of numbers. Okay, that's my point, and that is in fact true. It gets to the structure. You know, I as an agent, when I'm building an illustration, I can show declared current dividend scale. I can show half 50% dividend scale. There's a lot of different. Those are just two things. There's a lot of different things I can do. I can put riders on them, not riders on them. You have no idea. You cannot get to a legitimate conclusion by this wall of numbers, and most of the time by any wall of numbers, right? But then he goes on, but Lafayette Life agents really make a push to get your money working for you earlier, in the parentheses, to the agent's benefit and client's detriment. Well, that's just an accusation and an innuendo. I don't know what Lafayette Life agents do. I think for the most part, most agents are generally good people and want to do the right thing. They're either dishonest or less than honest or ignorant, my humble opinion. One can be fixed. I guess they both could be fixed. You know, you're either ignorant, which can be fixed, that could be corrected, or you're less than honest. I mean, it's a character issue. You know, which one do you want to work with? Not me, either. Okay. Then they even use Lafayette Life's single premium rider, which allows you to slam a big lump sum. Sounds better than it is. Every company has various PUA riders, and they all have a purpose. You know, he's just accusing agents of doing things that they may or may not be doing. I don't know. And then in bold, in order to fit that much money in the policy year in year one requires a massive amount of term that erodes cash values. That is partially true. And I agree that when you try to put so much premium into the PUA in year one with any company, it requires an awful lot of term, right? And with his policy construct, it does erode cash value, but it doesn't have to erode cash value if you do that. I agree that you shouldn't try to, you know, front load, fully fund, overpay, all the languages used out there. Try to get within the policy limits, all the money you can into the year one using whatever riders it requires to do. It does require an awful lot of death benefit term, right? Which is not to your benefit, right? Because we all have a limited amount of insurability. You know, if my insurability is $5 million maximum and it takes me $2.5 million maximum to be able to pay a premium, you know, what I've done, I've done a couple of things. Number one, I'm eating up insurability that I needlessly, right? And I'm paying for that. And I'm jeopardizing the long-term structure of a policy when you do that. And I don't care what company you're with when you do that. His, it requires a massive term rider. That's true. Or he continues that erodes cash value. Not necessarily true. Now, that term premium could have been paid in premium to the PUA or to the base. So the term rider, too much of a term rider, could, you know, it would call, it could be cause of less premium available for the PUA or the base. But when you use a blended PUA rider, then it does. It will eat up the cash value, or erodes cash value. So both could be true, but they don't have to be true, right? And the truth is, you should, if you're considering the infinite banking concept, you should work with somebody who can tailor a policy to you, your life, your family, and what you're doing. It's not that difficult to do, okay? He continues, we fully analyze this fallacy at his website, citing his website, right? Showing how staggering and smaller but steadier premiums over 4 years is better. Well, I agree that a premium paid out over longer duration, but I don't know why you got to get to 4 years. He's more manipulation. If four is good, is five better? If five's good, is seven better? If seven's good, is 10 better? If 10's good, is 15 better? I don't know. It's a legitimate question. He continues. He throws up another illustrations from two different companies trying to prove his point on that. Then he, in bold, I feel bad for anyone who got one of these dump-in policies last year and then pumped the lion's share of their liquidity into it. Yeah, I feel sorry for people who help them do that and people like you that do this and the people that actually do that. Is it at the end of the world? You know, I don't know, but if you want like legitimate, you want a legitimate policies that are with good companies that have the philosophy that aligns with yours, that has a financial philosophy that you would want in a company that you put money into, and then you want the flexibility to do all of the things that you think you want to do, that you know you want to do, you think you might want to do later, call our office. We can help. And it won't be a manipulative process, right? Anyone can schedule a 20-minute phone call with me or my son Jake and other people in this office. Nothing manipulative about it. It's really an educational experience, and it's good. Okay, now he continues. Now, after that big front-end loading of a policy, now they must either, one, kill the compounding of their PUAs to get liquidity. Not true, but of course, with a direct recognition company, yep, you're going to diminish, I don't know, kill the compounding of your liquidity, you know, to get liquidity, because there's going to be, in my example here, if you're going to kill the compounding, it's because you've collateralized it, and then there is an adjustment on the loan because it's a direct recognition company. But he's speaking specifically of Lafayette Life, and I'm telling you it's not true. Point two is borrow at seven without a boost. There again, like the boost is a good thing. The boost, in my opinion, is not a good at all. Not good. If the company isn't financially strong enough, managed financially well enough that they have to go outside and borrow money or sell off assets to pay a dividend, I don't think that's financially prudent. Now, could there be a certain circumstance where a company might want to borrow money and do something with it and take advantage of arbitrage? Of course, that's business 101. But let me say here, so he knows, he's keenly aware that Lafayette Life raised their interest rate at 7%. And I'm saying on policies issued after 2022, not all policies, and then the 5.3% dividend. Now, I know he's less than honest. Because if you know what the interest rate is, you should know what the dividend rate is, right? Wouldn't that make sense? And maybe not. I don't know. But in my mind, if you know, you only know the stuff you want to know, or you don't, you know everything that you should know, because the dividend rate is 5.75 on that policy, not 5.3. So it's like compounding, trying to make things, you know, sound bad or look bad or what have you. Okay. All right. But the problem just gets worse the longer you let it compound. Just so not true. There's no easy answer now except for taking advantage of Lafayette Life's major redeeming quality. Man, there's nothing you can do that's easy except their only redeeming quality. The high early cash value lets you jump off the pain train, giving you some options now before those middle or later years when the performance falls off a cliff, which is all straw man hyperbole. Just it's like almost, I'm going to take a shower after this, okay? See if I can get some of this stuff off of me. And so there's no good thing that you can do except take advantage of one redeeming quality. And then he offers you three in bold. Here are three things we have been modeling for other dissatisfied. So the assumption is that every Lafayette Life policyholder is dissatisfied. For other dissatisfied Lafayette Life policyholders, once they understand the dilemma they're in, this whole article, email, work adds nothing of truth or value or clarity to anyone's understanding unless you go through it line by line and kind of talk about it and point out the fallacies, the outright dishonesty, right? Now I understand, sir, how you do business. I get it. I understand. So my understanding has been increased in that aspect. Okay. Here are the three options. Number one, keep doing everything with Lafayette Life. Okay, well, if you did it right the first time, there's nothing wrong with doing that. All right, you don't have to fix something if it's not broke. Okay, that's legitimate. Two, do a 1035 exchange rollover to a true mutual office of your, to a true mutual of your choice. Man, a 1035 exchange is not a rollover, number one. I mean, you're a professional. You should use the correct language, but you weren't concerned about proper language or honesty anywhere else, so I get it. It would be a transfer you roll over from a 401k, okay? All right. In the mere fact that, you know, if, I think if any agent wants you to 1035 exchange, replace your existing policy, and in a 1035 exchange, those cash values, net surrender values, directly transfer from one company to another company. The basis, there's some benefits to a 1035 exchange. There's no question. But whenever 1035 exchange comes up, I mean, you need to, you the consumer, and my encouragement is to be crystal clear on why you're doing it and what it will look like after you do it, but what it would look like before you do it. Just clarity. This is what it is. What options do I have? Can I increase the premium, reduce the premium? What can I do with the policy that I have? Right? And what does that look like, whether I do something or don't? And then what would it look like if I did 1035 exchange those values to another policy? What would that look like? Right? And clear expectations, right, or understanding of what it looks like to do nothing and what it looks like to do something, and consider just total consideration of what you're doing. You know, you're going to give up death benefit that was, you know, probably if it was built prior to 2022, it's a completely different basis of calculation than a policy issued after 2022. Right. That's just an example. But there are legitimate reasons to 1035 exchange to directly, you know, target a particular company, disparage them, and then encourage an exchange. I question the legality of that as well. And I don't think it's prudent generally to replace policies. Sometimes it is. Generally, it's not. You should understand the ramifications of replacing or not replacing before you take any action. My humble opinion and encouragement. Number three, pay the absolute minimum toward the Lafayette Life while sending your overfunding into an optimized policy with a true mutual of your choice. Let me break that down for you in my humble layman terms, all right? Pay the absolute minimum premium toward the PUA while sending those PUA premium dollars into a manipulated policy that I created with a mutual company that has not demutualized at present, okay, of your choice. Wonder what the fourth option would be. Would there be a fourth option? I think there would. I read this yesterday, the day before, and I'm like, yeah, it doesn't even mention option four. Ah, here it is. Learn what you have, the policy that you have. Learn what you can do with that policy and what you cannot do with that policy. Learn a little bit about the company. Learn, make sure you're comfortable with whomever you're working with. But primarily, learn what you can do with the policies that you have and what you cannot do. Are your expectations aligned? Has your situation changed? Maybe so, but that doesn't mean you have to replace a policy, right? But learn what you can do with what you have. And is it sufficient? Is it meeting your needs? Is it checking all the boxes that it originally checked when you purchased it? Maybe, maybe not. If it hadn't, does that mean you have to 1035 exchange and replace and do all this other stuff? No, it does not. I'm just saying the fourth option is to learn what you have, okay? All right. And then Bold, he continues, seeing the numbers really helps people make the best choice for themselves. I sell life insurance off of illustrations. I'm going to manipulate an illustration and make the numbers look bigger, better, faster, sooner. So you'll say yes. And I'll say all of these other things, half-truths, innuendos, omissions, some just outright lies, full of disparagement, to help you say yes. Yeah, not interested. All right, we can help make sense of this and all your other options and transform this potential unwinnable situation into something sustainable. So that's about all I can take. Anyway, I hope that's of some kind of value. If you own Lafayette Life, I don't care who you own, whomever you own, learn about that company from maybe somebody who's not angry with the company or trying to compete against the company, somebody who actually knows and understands and is forthright, honest, and truthful, maybe educational, comprehensive, you know, has some clarity, help you understand or see things that you didn't see or know things that you didn't know, right? Learn what you have, right? That would be my encouragement. And then, you know, I've asked myself, you know, why would I even take the time to address something like this? You know, I'm not a water boy for the life insurance company. You know, full disclosure, yeah, I write Lafayette Life Insurance. I own Lafayette Life Insurance personally. And, you know, I own it. Well, let me say that we write for multiple companies. And every company that we write for, we own and have owned. First ones. I'm the first one to own anything that I encourage my clients to consider, right? That's just me. But I'm still not a water boy for them. I own multiple policies across multiple companies. Some are direct recognition, some are non-direct recognition, some are big, some are large. They're all a little different. You know, the premiums are a little different, the durations are a little different. But I asked myself, James, why would you even spend any amount of time on this? You know, because I don't care what people do in generally. And I guess, you know, to me, why does it bother me? You know, it bothers me because it's so less than honest and manipulative. And I just hate that. I don't like that. And I believe everyone should consider the power of the infinite banking concept. You should read Becoming Your Own Banker. And then if it resonates with you, if you think that's something that you'd like to do, learn, you know, learn how to implement it in your life without all of these preconceived, narrated, the sales marketing type stuff, right? And that bothers me. And then, you know, it also makes me think, you know, while I'm thinking, why do I even want to do this? You know, Nelson had a quote. He used to say, accentuate the positive, decentuate the negative, and stay away from Mr. In-Between, right? And now that was a modified quote from a song lyrics. And I'm like, am I focusing on, you know, am I, you know, accentuating the negative, you know, am I, and no, I don't believe I am, right? I'm trying to accentuate clarity, right? That's all I'm trying to do, right? If you want to buy a policy, great, go buy. If you want to buy one of these, go great. If you want to engage with them and you love them and whatever, or that type of marketing, no problem. But learn what you have, right? Learn what's going on. I'm convinced if you know what's going on, you'll know what to do. Another quote from Nelson Nash. And so if I know what's going on with something like that, I'll know what to do, right? Me personally, and I think you're no different. You know, I think you're the same. So I'm not trying to, you know, point out negative or be negative. I am trying to, the negative of this is the way that the spirit, the letter, the construct, the manipulation, the less than honest, the lack of trust. I mean, all of that's negative. There's no question. I'm not trying to accentuate that, right? I am trying to point it out. You know, if I'm walking along the road and my friend's with me and I see a hole in front of them and they're going to fall into it, you know, I feel somewhat obligated to say, hey, there's a hole. You know, and maybe this individual and people like him firmly believe in what they're doing and how they're doing it, you know, and they may have the same perspective. You know, it's hard for me to truly believe that whenever you know some things about a company and other things, you know, you should know, but you don't, you know, present them on an equal, transparent, you know, in an equal and transparent manner for true, real comparison for the consumer. I don't have any more grace to give that kind of marketing, right? Anyway, but I'm not trying to be negative. I want to be encouraging, but please, you know, I'll retract that. You know, it's like, okay, just learn what you have, learn what's really going on. I'm convinced that you'll know what to do. Okay. And if you don't know what to do, you know, you can reach out to us and we're not going to manipulate you into anything. Zero, nothing, nada. Right. I know I could continue talking, but I'm going to stop here. Thanks for hanging out with me and listening. Have a great day.
Thank you for joining us on the Banking with Life podcast. If you're watching on YouTube, make sure to like and subscribe and click on that little notification bell. Otherwise, join us on Apple Podcasts and Stitcher for weekly content.